This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that he might try you by what he has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and he is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's president says resistance is the only way to stop Israel's savagery and aggression, and those who think otherwise are changing their approach. Asian stock markets slide following a broadly negative cues from Wall Street overnight as the Federal Reserve delivers another big interest rate hike to cool galloping inflation. And Russia and Ukraine carry out the largest prisoner swap since the war began, involving almost 300 people, including 10 foreigners fighting for Kiev. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, the Iranian president says Lebanon has proved resistance is the only way to stop the Zionist regime's savagery and aggression. Ebrahim Raisi made the remark in a meeting with the Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly meeting. He said that those who thought Israel could be countered without resistance have realized their errors and are now mending their ways. Raisi stressed normalization of relations with some regional countries will not bring security to Israel, but only deepen regional people's hatred for the regime. The Iranian president also touched on Lebanon's internal politics, saying all ethnic groups in the country need to unite to create a powerful government. Raisi said Iran attaches great importance to the security and peace of Lebanon. And the Iranian president has also called for the prosecution of former U.S. President Donald Trump for ordering the assassination of top general Qasem Soleimani.
The fair pursuit of justice in the face of the crime the former American president admitted to is serving the humanity. We will seek through a fair tribunal to bring to justice those who ordered and those who committed the martyrdom of our beloved general Qasem Soleimani.
Addressing the UN General Assembly, Raisi underlined the Islamic Republic will legally pursue the U.S. assassination of the anti-terror icon. He also hailed Iran's role for confronting high-handed and interventionist policies, including, quote, U.S.-crafted terrorism. Elsewhere in his remarks, Raisi strongly condemned the West for applying double standards when it comes to the issues of human rights. He said those supporting rights violations and terrorism must be held to account. The Iranian president also stressed the need for multilateralism, saying it has far-reaching significance for a just world. Journalist and author Daniel Lazar says the U.S. has gone to great lengths to protect its global hegemonic status.
The demise of the Soviet Union in 1991 essentially left the U.S. as the sole remaining superpower, and the U.S. has done its best to make the most of that of its status by imposing its rules on on all other countries, or doing its best to, and tolerating absolutely no dissent. So, you know, so a country like Iran finds itself, you know, under attack by America, under ceaseless attack. I mean, its scientists are killed, its top generals are assassinated, it's subject to a brutal economic blockade. And it just goes to show how fundamentally intolerant the American hegemon really is. And other countries which run afoul of America, Nicaragua, for example, Venezuela, or certainly Russia, receive the same treatment. And this kind of unilateral assertion of American power, can only lead to confrontation and war. There simply is no way out of a military showdown.
Asian markets extend a painful Wall Street sell-off following a further hike in Federal Reserve interest rates. Shares fell in China, Japan, and South Korea on Thursday. Markets in Singapore, Indonesia, and the Philippines were also in the red. That's after all three benchmarks in Wall Street finished more than 1.7% down, with the U.S. Federal Reserve raising interest rates by 0.75% for a third consecutive time this year. New hike brings the central bank's benchmark interest rate to its highest level since 2008. Fed boss Jerome Powell said the central bank will stay the course with its aggressive measures to bring 40-year high inflation down. He admitted such policies will affect the American economy, but said there is no easier way to tackle rising prices. The European Union is planning to impose new sanctions against Russia over Moscow's military operation in Ukraine.
Additional restrictive measures against Russia will be brought forward immediately, as soon as possible, in coordination with our partners. In line with United Nations Charter.
European Union High Representative added that Europe will continue to support Ukraine and provide military equipment as long as needed. He also condemned plans for a referenda in parts of Ukraine to join Russia. Meanwhile, the Russian President Vladimir Putin warned the West that Moscow will use all available means to respond to threats against the country. Putin also ordered Russia's first mobilization since World War II, which will likely add 300,000 reservists to support its military efforts in Ukraine. Meanwhile, Russia and Ukraine have carried out their largest prisoner swap since the war began in late February, involving almost 300 people. Under the terms of the deal, 215 Ukrainians were released, in addition to 10 foreigners who fought for Kiev. Among those released were 5 commanders. In exchange, Ukraine sent back 55 Russians and pro-Moscow Ukrainians. Leader of a banned pro-Russian party who's facing treason charges was also sent to Russia. Ukraine said Turkey and Saudi Arabia helped with the prisoner swap. Kiev says the swap was under preparation for quite some time and involved intense haggling. Now, the Italian elections are just around the corner. Opinion polls show leader of far-right Brothers of Italy party is a leading candidate to replace outgoing Premier Mario Draghi. Max Civilli reports from Rome.
Italy is bracing itself for fresh elections on September 25 after the government of national unity led by Mario Draghi collapsed at the end of July. The former president of the European Central Bank and Goldman Sachs managing director Draghi had lost support of the once anti-establishment five-star movement, the League and Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia. These three parties failed to back him in a confidence vote on his leadership, triggering a government crisis that ended with President Sergio Mattarella calling for snap elections. This will be the first time the Italians go to the polls in September in the country's Republican history.
There is a strong disaffection with politics in Italy, but while in the elections held 5 years ago, the five-star movement was able to intercept people's anger and dissatisfaction. This time, there doesn't seem to be a party strong enough to do the same.
According to final polls, a right-wing coalition is on course to win a comfortable majority of seats in both houses of the parliament, with the far-right Brothers of Italy party likely to win about 25% of the vote. Its leader, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni, could be Italy's next prime minister, the Italian media have reported. Her party took around 4% of votes in the last election in 2018.
I don't have faith in establishment politics, but I don't know who to vote for. At the same time, I think not voting could be even worse. I'm really undecided.
The truth is that I don't have much trust in politicians. Will they be able to keep their electoral pledges?
A few days ago, the US government warned that Russian cash had been funneled to Italian parties sympathetic to the Kremlin without specifying which groups had been the recipients of the funds. Some analysts have seen the US move as a warning to those parties which had expressed sympathy for Russian President Vladimir Putin over the past years.
I think the cabinet secretary with the security brief has already made clear that no Italian politicians nor political parties have received funding from Moscow. If Russia has meddled in elections held in foreign countries, it goes without saying the US certainly did the same.
Over 51 million Italians are entitled to vote at the weekend. Sunday's elections will be held amid general disaffection and political discredit. Recent surveys have shown that some 35% of the Italians won't show up at the polls, a trend that, if confirmed, could put turnout at a record low. Max Civili, Rome.
Chaos prevails throughout England's Midland cities as a bitter dispute between Muslim and Hindu communities escalates. Clashes and scuffles were reported in Leicester over the weekend, while another standoff occurred outside a Hindu temple in Birmingham on Tuesday. Robert Carter has your story.
Tensions between British Hindus and Muslims have escalated recently, with the unrest mostly involving young men from both communities and leading to scuffles and assaults. On Tuesday, hundreds of masked Muslim men descended on a Hindu temple in Birmingham. Local Muslims were furious over a recent attempt by the temple to platform a hardline Indian preacher.
Things are a bit tasty here, but ultimately the reason that they've gathered in these numbers is because this centre was planning to platform a very notorious BJP representative who espouses the Hindutva fascist ideology, which is very prominent in India right now and is responsible for a lot of anti-Muslim hate crimes which have taken place there. That ideology has essentially been exported now, unfortunately, into the streets of Britain, and it's been leading up to the point over months.
Tuesday's unrest was sparked following a Hindu mob marching through Muslim-majority areas in the nearby city of Leicester on Saturday, chanting Hindutva slogans. Eyewitnesses say the marchers attacked local Muslim businesses and intimidated the community. Local police failed to stop the rally, which was later confronted by a crowd of Muslims. According to some reports, the violence flared up after a recent Asia Cup cricket match between arch-rivals India and Pakistan. However, Muslims in Leicester have been routinely targeted by Hindu thugs way before the match.
And they think they can do the same thing here, what they can do in India. We've lived with Hindus for decades, never had any issues whatsoever until these guys came along. These young men came along, and they've caused so much grief here. And most Muslims here are very peaceful. They've turned the other cheek for so long, turned the other cheek, called the police. Police haven't done anything. Their inaction has caused this. So I blame the police for this.
As UK police scramble to investigate many incidents, the feud has gone global, as India and Pakistan's high commissions issued passionate statements condemning either side of the divide, fading any hopes of a quick solution to the chaos. Robert Carter, Leicester.
And now to Pakistan, where hundreds of people have died from malaria and other diseases in flood-ravaged regions due to unhygienic conditions.
The number of our patients has increased by 20 to 30% because of the floods. That is because they are drinking the open flood water, which has increased the number of patients suffering from malaria and gastric conditions. We usually do not have so many malaria patients, but now 8 or 9 out of 10 sick children coming to us are suffering from malaria.
According to authorities, fatalities have reached 324 in some regions of Sindh province, one of the worst hit areas in southern Pakistan. Malaria has been spreading quickly among flood refugees who live around stagnant waters. Sindh provincial government says makeshift health facilities and mobile camps in flooded areas have treated more than 78,000 patients in the past 24 hours and more than 2 million since the 1st of July. It's confirmed 665 new cases of malaria among internally displaced families over the same period, with another 9,200 suspected cases. But more immediate help is needed for the displaced families exposed to swarms of mosquitoes and other hazards such as snakes and dog bites. An ancient archaeological site has been unearthed in the besieged Gaza Strip. Location reveals well-preserved Byzantine-era mosaic floors. Our Gaza correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, tells us more.
A 1,500-year-old archaeological site dating back to the Byzantine era has been found in central Gaza. The site contains mosaic floors depicting various animals and bird designs, as well as day-to-day life in the Byzantine era. A total of 17 images grace the colorful mosaic floors. Excavations have also revealed evidence of structures from the remains of old walls. Experts say the artifacts are one of the most important discoveries in the blockaded territory.
This is a great archaeological treasure, and we believe that this site used to serve as a Byzantine temple. This place indicates that there was a thriving community living in the area. The graphic representation of the mosaics is amazing and very complex.
The credit for the historic discovery goes to Palestinian farmer Salman Al-Nabahin. Salman was working on his farm when he stumbled upon the archaeological treasure. Upon the discovery of the mosaics, he notified the local authorities.
I was digging the ground with my son to plant new olive trees, and we hit a hard surface. At first, we thought that it was a rock, but we kept digging and realized that it was something historic. We searched on the internet and we discovered that it was an ancient mosaic floor.
The Gaza Strip is rich with antiquities from different civilizations. Most of its artifacts were stolen during the Israeli occupation of the territory. Nonetheless, archaeological sites are still being found by both archaeologists and individuals.
The Palestinian people are fighting a cultural and historical battle with the Zionist enemy. Zionists claim that Palestine did not have any people in the past, but discoveries such as this one prove that the people of Palestine lived here for thousands of years.
Many here only hope that this important archaeological discovery would draw attention to this isolated part of the world. The beautiful mosaics found in this site unveil the rich history of the area that used to be a major trade route between Asia and Africa in ancient times. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought this sight-giving day through his mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Little Layan Ashair, the recent child victim of the Zionist regime's assault on Gaza, is a clear instance that the fabricated regime of Israel feels free in committing crimes against humanity. The Zionist regime, which is after ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, don't care if its victims are as young as Layan or old and disabled. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for more. Electronic Intifada described the story of Layan in this way. It was a scorching afternoon in Gaza. Layan Ashair, 10, wanted to play on the seashore. It was her idea that we go to the beach, Layan's mother, Hala, said. She was so excited. I want to have a trip to the beach before I go back to school, Layan told me. Using a van rented from a neighbor, several members of the extended family set off from where they live in Khan Yunis area. Musleh, Layan's father, stayed at home. Recalling how he waved at Layan as the van drove off, Musleh said, I didn't know that this would be the last time I would see the smile of my little girl. Soon after they had set out, a missile was fired at a truck from an Israeli regime drone. The Zionist regime had begun a major attack against Gaza on that day, August 5. My children and their cousins were chatting and singing, Hala, Layan's mother said. Then In the blink of an eye, there was an explosion and the van's floor was covered in blood. Realizing that Layan had been badly injured, her cousin Kemal got out of the van and hailed a passing car. Its driver brought Layan to Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. Musleh, Layan's father, received a phone call from Hala, his wife. She was so shocked that Musleh had trouble grasping what she was saying. Musleh said, "I was just able to understand that the truck was hit in an Israeli strike and that Layan was severely wounded." Layan spent a number of days at the European hospital. For the most of that time, the Zionist regime kept on bombarding Gaza. As her condition deteriorated, her father insisted that she should be taken outside Gaza for specialized treatments unavailable inside the strip. On August 9th, Layan was driven in an ambulance to Maqasid Hospital in occupied East Al-Quds. Layan's mother accompanied her. Musleh, her father, sought a travel permit from the occupied territories so that he could join them in Al-Quds. He was unable to get the documentation in time. 2 days later, Layan died. Musleh said, "I wanted to see Layan before she died, but I couldn't. This has broken my heart." Layan was among 17 children killed because of the Zionist regime's attack on Gaza last month. The Zionist regime knows that it can terrorize Palestinians without being held into account. The Zionist regime authorities even tried to avoid being blamed for some of the deaths. For example, the Zionist regime's military initially claimed that a rocket misfired by Islamic Jihad caused the deaths of 5 children in Al-Fallujah Cemetery, northern Gaza, on August 7th. Later that month, the Zionist regime admitted that it killed the 5 children. Defense for Children International Palestine has established that the Zionist regime directly killed 3 other Palestinian children in airstrikes during the August offensive. The organization's assessment was published shortly before Layan Ashar's death was announced. Al-Haq, another Palestinian human rights group, has documented how the Israeli regime repeatedly targeted the homes of civilians last month, including many homes where children lived. Targeting civilian homes and infrastructure violates the principle of distinction, enshrined in the Rome Statute of International Criminal Court. That principle requires warring parties to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants. Al-Haq has contended that the Israeli regime's use of drones and other weapons against civilian buildings may amount to war crimes. Layan Ashar will be remembered forever. Middle East Eye also wrote, "Layan Ashar 10 becomes the 48th Palestinian victim of the 3-day Israeli regime assault. She became the 48th Palestinian victim of the Zionist regime's military assault on the Gaza Strip, which included 4 women and 17 children. Another 360 Palestinians, including 151 children, were wounded, and some remain at risk of losing their lives." The Palestinian Health Ministry said that Shaer had been hit by shrapnel that damaged vital areas in her brain. On August 5th, the Zionist regime launched a 3-day attack on Gaza before an Egyptian brokered ceasefire came into effect on August 7th. On August 9th, 4 Palestinians were killed by Israeli regime fire in the occupied West Bank, including senior resistance Ibrahim al-Nablusi and 2 children. Hossein Jamal Taha, 16, and Mo'amen Yasin Jaber, 17. Since the start of the year, the Zionist regime forces have killed more than 130 Palestinians, including at least 34 children, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Persian language in India.
Part 2.
India, a land with gushing rivers and green forests, an ancient culture and national treasures that harken back to a time long since past, and which, with history as its witness, has put many a hard time behind it with the help of various cultural attributes like language. India has managed to introduce itself to the world as a country that takes pride in its cultural history. In the first episode, the role of the Persian language and the Persian culture in India was revealed. We saw how Farsi, which took root in India 800 years ago, has managed to achieve many things in the realms of art, culture, poetry and verse, architecture, social dynamics, politics, and economics. The Persian tongue has been an undeniable influence in all this. A language that has been the language of culture, politics, and art for centuries.
India and Iran, they are very unique in terms of, you know, their experiences, in terms of their values and culture, in terms of their paradigm, in terms of their political experiences. This uniqueness basically brings a kind of unity of the two different cultures who have experienced more or less same thing, the same problems, the same kind of exploitation by the external forces. And this experience and this kind of, you know, the historical experiences, facing a lot of problems and challenges, that make both the countries very intelligent, wise, hardworking, and forward-looking. And this is what I say, the heritage of both the countries. This is the civilizational heritage of both India and Iran that make them unique in this whole world.
Arshi Khan's comments speak to the deep-rooted relations between Iran and India over centuries.
relations that went beyond the day-to-day social contacts and took on a spiritual aspect. The Persian language hasn't acted as a tool to plunder India's natural wealth. Rather, it's been perceived as the reason behind the deep spiritual relations between the two nations. As you saw at the beginning of this study, Farsi turned into a language of poetry, human relations, administration of justice, maintaining law and order, and the development of spiritual thoughts. The thousands of documents written in Farsi are held in Indian libraries and cultural centers. But the Persian language, which was once very much a part of people's lives in India, has been threatened by various elements. As a result, India and the history of the Persian language in this nation have drifted apart. The year 1832, the beginning of Britain's colonization of India, also marks the beginning of the British government's attack on the Persian language. Britain had occupied India with the help of its powerful military and fought with the people. In that way, it imposed itself onto India's history. But what prevented Britain from impacting the Indian people's culture was none other than the Persian language, with its beauty and richness. But the British launched a deliberate attack on Farsi and weakened it. Now, in the year 2012, I ask language researchers to tell me more about Farsi.
The aim of them, the goal of the British, was actually to try to attract the attention of the Indian people, whether it were Hindus, whether it were Muslims, because they would think, look, these people, they are not foreigners, they are not aliens. They come here, they are trying to adopt their own culture. Because, you know, when you speak the language, when you adopt some parts of the culture, I mean, the strangeness or even enmity, it actually it reduces or vanishes from there. So this is one of the tricks used by the British. First to attract the people towards them. Then to follow the policy of divide and rule. Now they try to create the differences between the Hindus and between the Muslims and between the Sunnis and between the Shias. And even among the Hindus themselves, they try to do that. And they realize that since Persian is so much widely spread all over India, the basic factor combining the people of India is Persian, because the Persians, the people of the south, they have their own languages. The people of Kashmir and Punjab and Sindh and other people, they have their own languages. But the lingua franca, the language which they used to converse with each other, was Persian.
The research tells us that one of the obstacles Britain faced in achieving its cultural objectives in India was the Persian language, and so it was targeted. The plan was to eradicate Farsi from Indian lives, and eventually English replaced Farsi in India.
But when the British came, they wanted to, you know, to disturb two, three things, I must tell you. They were not in a position immediately to take militarily India, or military takeover immediately. They did not do this. In the beginning, they basically captured the economic market. So they first approached the economy. So you find the British came as a businessman here in India. Then after economics, they wanted to play politics. And then they, you know, brewed the feud and divide between different kings, etc. And they began to capture some lands, especially the coastal areas like Bombay, like Calcutta, etc., like Madras. So you find that when the British came, they were not comfortable with the Indian tradition. They were not comfortable with the Indian grassroots level administration like panchayat, like janapadas, like Mughal institutions, governing institutions. They were not comfortable with this. Because these institutions were not thought to be benefiting the British, because British had their own agenda, and that agenda was to exploit the country. Because Mughals were here not to exploit the country. The Sultanate King, the Muslims, were here not to exploit the country.
What history bears witness to is that Britain invaded India before cultural ties were firmly established. They came with their military might and careful planning.
After achieving several goals, in 1850, Britain decided it was time to target the people's culture and languages.
The first thing the British did was to ban Persian, the teaching of Persian, in areas under their control. Of course, there are so many other states which are not directly under the control of the British. Like we had Hyderabad, we had Bhopal, we had some other small principalities which were having the local rule, not directly under the British, although the external affairs were in the hands of the British. In these places, the Persian was there, but in the central places, I mean the central provinces, or the parts of India or Pakistan, what you call it now, which were under the direct rule of the British, here they banned the use of Persian language. And first they encouraged Urdu, and then they replaced it with English. Because as I said, it was easier for them to rule India. Because once the English language became dominant, they can rule the people. They can divide them further. And it was in these times, more divisions happened in it because of the difference of languages. As long as the people used to follow the Persian language, they were united.
After the collapse of Muslim power, Britishers came here. They replaced the language, official language, with English. And the madrasa institutions were compelled by the system to introduce Hindi and English in their courses. So due to these changes, political changes, the importance of Persian language was minimized. This was a political change. That Persian language could not be retained as the official language or the language more than other languages. So it was only due to the political reasons.
It's because of the English or the British control over India in the 19th century and how gradually the British, they seized all parts of India. And when they found that the cultural links between the Iranians and the Indians were quite deep, they wanted to, as part of the policy of divide and rule, they wanted to separate the two peoples so that it would be easier for them to separate them, rule them. So I think that's one of the reasons, as you said, as you pointed out, that for the time being, the relations in the political sphere, we have only to do with the oil, the purchase of oil from Iran, and this exchange of students, because there are so many students studying in India because of the technology and the language that the Indians have. There are so many Iranians going to the Indian universities and studying over there. And there are so many other items as well, because if you look at the carpet trade, because even the carpets in Kashmir, they have been influenced by the Iranian carpets. And there are so many other factors we can discuss and elaborate upon in the course of time.
By attacking India's ancient culture and the Persian language, Britain became an alien entity in the eyes of the people. I myself am curious as to how the Persian language and culture managed to affect every aspect of India, only via culture. To write poetry and invite the people to love and friendship, while the British onslaught was so determined to separate them from those things. What a difference.
When India became, this Indo-Pakistan subcontinent became a colony of the Britishers. And one of the very important things for them was not only occupy it for political gains, but to transform it culturally and delink its people with their rich past. So that was initiated by the Britishers. So they changed their law, which was Islamic jurisprudential law, which was here in this whole subcontinent. And they just, language is one of the targets of the colonial powers. And so they wanted to delink the people with their rich cultural past. And one of them was replacing the language. Though Urdu is a cultural continuation of Persian, and Urdu, after 1947, particularly, it was in a way ostracized and marginalized, being described as a communal language. So the people in India, they were bereft of this very rich language, rich legacy. And when the people are bereft of their legacies, cultural legacies, they are subject to manipulations.
It's quite contrary to what the relations they had with British. British came here as an
power of occupied powers. They didn't treat this as their own country. They wanted India for some reasons, and they used it for some reasons. But for those who came from the immediate West, whether from Iran or from, they adopted India. Even the kings who came, even the Mughals came, or whoever came from that, the Central Asia or these parts, they made it their own country. They came here, they lived here, and they had relations with the locals. They adopted it their own country, and they treated it as their own country. I don't think that anybody in India now, you heard that they will tell you that the Mughals came from outside. They treat them as their own kings. They treated them their own. They treated their own rulers. So this is not the case with the British. So these two rulers rules these two periods had entirely different dynamics. There had been continuous migrations for centuries from Iran to this part of the world. You'll see there are lots of Indians who claimed themselves as an Iranian descent. So they lived here, they made it their home, and they are as happy as anything.
It's because of this that the Indian culture is still brimming with elements of the Persian language, unaffected by colonialism and politics. Books, inscriptions, society, the spoken languages of India all display Persian influences and all speak of love, friendship, God, and life. They hearken back to a time when Persian had prominence.
It's very essential to know that because earlier, the Farsi was the court language also, and all the documents, even during the British period, were written in Farsi. So that has to be, it was a subject which one has to know. The sale deeds and the property papers, the documents, they were all in Farsi. It is only later that Urdu replaced it, and thereafter other languages, English and Hindi and other languages.
So far as I know about the relationship of India and Iran, this relationship is of, I think, a cordial relationship, because give-and-take relationship. The impact of Iranian language, because the Mughals were the rulers, for many years they used Iranian language in their judicial language or in their court language it was, and various poets such as, you can say, Sadi, Rumi, and generally people consider that Rumi is their mentor, a spiritual mentor, as Allama Iqbal, one of the most, important poet philosopher of Indian subcontinent.
The imagination of the men and women of this land still takes to its wings at the sight of the poems of great poets such as Sa'di, Hafiz, Jami, and Maulavi. They take a trip down memory lane and remember the good times for India. And the young in this vast country, just like their ancestors, consider Farsi as a window to their history and the time when the Persian language was in widespread use. Today, poetry in India is not only an arrangement of rhyming words, but also a statement speaking of the culture, relation, and the life of the Eastern man, and on top of it all, the human relations between the two nations. I leave India firm in the notion that this great country, with all its beauty, its warm-hearted people and history, owes some of its success to the Persian language. India's libraries, architecture, and its elderly bear witness to that. And finally,
I'm reminded of a line from the poet Iqbal Lahori that represents the deep-rooted cultural relations between the nations of the region and the role of the Persian language in making that bond stronger. A poem that would probably lose its meaning in translation if rendered into English. Like a lantern, I burn on your street. Oh, the youth of Persia, believe me, I have spent a big part of my life thinking, until I came to understand your hidden thoughts.
In the limelight. Over the course of this summer, the nation has been transfixed by the House Select Committee's hearings on the events of 6th of January 2021 and how or whether Donald Trump might face accountability for what happened on that day. The article you're about to hear has been published in the opinion section of the New York Times. The piece is titled, Donald Trump is Not Above the Law, and it's been written by the editorial board of the newspaper. Over the course of this summer, America has been transfixed by the House Select Committee's hearings on the events of 6th of January 2021 and how or whether Donald Trump might face accountability for what happened on that day. The Justice Department remained largely silent about its investigations of the former president until this month, when the FBI searched his home in Palm Beach, Florida, in a case related to his handling of classified documents. The spectacle of a former president facing criminal investigation raises profound questions about American democracy, and these questions demand answers. Donald Trump's unprecedented assault on the integrity of American democracy requires a criminal investigation. The disturbing details of his post-election malfeasance, meticulously assembled by the January 6th committee, leave little doubt that Mr. Trump sought to subvert the Constitution and overturn the will of the American people. The president, defeated at the polls in 2020, tried to enlist federal law enforcement authorities, state officials, and administrators of the nation's electoral system in a furious effort to remain in power. When all else failed, he roused an armed mob that stormed the Capitol and threatened lawmakers. The Justice Department is reportedly examining Mr. Trump's conduct, including his role in trying to overturn the election and in taking home classified documents. If Attorney General Merrick Garland and his staff conclude that there is sufficient evidence to establish Donald Trump's guilt on a serious charge in a court of law, then they must seek an indictment too. This board is aware that in deciding how Donald Trump should be held accountable under the law, it is necessary to consider not just whether criminal prosecution would be warranted, but whether it would be wise. No American president has ever been criminally prosecuted after leaving office. When President Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, he ensured that Nixon would not be prosecuted for crimes committed during the Watergate scandal. Gerald Ford explained his decision with the warning that such a prosecution posed grave risk of rousing ugly passions and worsening political polarization. That warning is just as salient today. Pursuing prosecution of Donald Trump could further entrench support for him and play into the conspiracy theories he has sought to stoke. It could inflame the bitter partisan divide, even to the point of civil unrest. A trial, if it is viewed as illegitimate, could also further undermine confidence in the rule of law, whatever the eventual outcome. The risks of political escalation are obvious. The Democratic and Republican parties are already in the thick of a cycle of retribution that could last generations. There is a substantial risk that, if the Justice Department does prosecute Donald Trump, future presidents, whether Mr. Trump himself or someone of his ilk, could misuse the precedent to punish political rivals. If their party takes a majority in the House of Representatives after the midterm elections, some Republicans have already threatened to impeach President Biden. There is an even more immediate threat of further violence, and it is a possibility that Americans should, sadly, be prepared for. In the hours after federal agents began a court-approved search of Donald Trump's residence in Palm Beach, based on a warrant investigating possible violations of three federal laws, including one that governs the handling of defense information under the Espionage Act, his most fervent supporters escalated their rhetoric to the language of warfare. As the New York Times noted, the aggressive widespread response was arguably the clearest outburst of violent public rhetoric since the days leading up to the 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol. Merrick Garland has been deliberate, methodical, and scrupulous in his leadership of the Justice Department's investigation of the January 6 attack and the transfer of documents to Donald Trump's home. On Friday, a redacted version of the affidavit used to obtain the warrant was released, revealing that the Justice Department asked to search the premises to recover documents because of concerns that their disclosure could compromise clandestine human sources of intelligence, and because it had probable cause to believe it would find evidence of obstruction at the premises. No matter how careful Merrick Garland is, or how measured the prosecution might be, there is a real and significant risk from those who believe that any criticism of Donald Trump justifies an extreme response. Yet, it is a far greater risk to do nothing when action is called for. Aside from letting Mr. Trump escape punishment, doing nothing to hold him accountable for his actions in the months leading up to the January 6 assault could set an irresistible precedent for future presidents. Why not attempt to stay in power by any means necessary or use the power of the office to enrich oneself or punish one's enemies, knowing that the law does not apply to presidents in or out of office? More importantly, democratic government is an ideal that must constantly be made real. America is not sustained by a set of principles. It is sustained by resolute action to defend those principles. Immediately after the January 6th insurrection, cabinet members reportedly debated privately whether to remove Donald Trump from power under the authority of the 25th Amendment. A week after the attack, the House impeached Mr. Trump for the second time. This editorial board supported his impeachment and removal from office. We also suggested that the former president and lawmakers who participated in the January 6th plot could be permanently barred from holding office under a provision of the 14th Amendment that applies to any official who has engaged in insurrection or rebellion, or given aid or comfort to those who have done so. But most Republicans in the Senate refused to convict Donald Trump, and Congress has yet to invoke that section of the 14th Amendment against him. As a result, the threat that Donald Trump and his most ardent supporters pose to American democracy has metastasized. Even now, the former president continues to spread lies about the 2020 election and denounce his vice president, Mike Pence, for not breaking the law on his behalf. Meanwhile, dozens of people who believe Mr. Trump's lies are running for state and national elected office. Many have already won, some of them elevated to positions that give them control over how elections are conducted. In June, the Republican Party in Texas approved measures in its platform declaring that Mr. Biden's election was illegitimate. And Donald Trump appears prepared to start a bid for a second term as president. Mr. Trump's actions as a public official, like no other since the Civil War, attacked the heart of our system of government. He used the power of his office to subvert